anger, not even your indifference. I've never taken much from the world. I haven't wanted much. I've never really wanted anything, not in the total, undivided way, not with the kind of desire that becomes an ultimatum, yes or no, and one can't accept the no without ceasing to exist. That's what you are to me. But when one reaches that stage, it's not the object that matters, it's the desire, not you, but I. The ability to desire like that. Nothing less is worth feeling or honoring. And I've never felt that before, Dominique. I've never known how to say mine about anything. Not in the sense I say it about you. Mine. Did you call it a sense of life as exaltation? You said that. You understand. I can't be afraid. I love you, Dominique. I love you. You're letting me say it now. I love you. She reached over and took the cablegram off the mirror. She crumpled it, her fingers twisting slowly in a grinding motion against her palm. He stood listening to the crackle of the paper. She leaned forward, opened her hand over the wastebasket, and let the paper drop. Her hand remained still for a moment, the fingers extended, slanting down, as they had opened. Part 4. Howard Rourke. Chapter 1. The leaves streamed down, trembling in the sun. They were not green. Only a few scattered through the torrent stood out in single drops of a green so bright and pure that it hurt the eyes. The rest were not a color, but a light, the substance of fire on metal, living sparks without edges. And it looked as if the forest were a spread of light boiling slowly to produce this color, this green rising in small bubbles, the condensed essence of spring. The trees met, bending over the road, and the spots of sun on the ground moved with the shifting of the branches like a conscious caress. The young man hoped he would not have to die. Not if the earth could look like this, he thought. Not if he could hear the hope and the promise, like a voice, with leaves, tree trunks, and rocks, instead of words. But he knew that the earth looked like this only because he had seen no sign of men for hours. He was alone riding his bicycle down a forgotten trail through the hills of Pennsylvania, where he had never been before, where he could feel the fresh wonder of an untouched world. He was a very young man. He had just graduated from college in the spring of the year 1935, and he wanted to decide whether life was worth living. He did not know that this was the question in his mind. He did not think of dying. He thought only that he wished to find joy and reason and meaning in life, and that none had been offered to him anywhere. He had not liked the things taught to him in college. He had been taught a great deal about social responsibility, about a life of service and self-sacrifice. Everybody had said it was beautiful and inspiring. Only he had not felt inspired. He had felt nothing at all. He could not name the thing he wanted of life. He felt it here, in this wild loneliness. But he did not face nature with the joy of a healthy animal, as a proper and final setting. He faced it with the joy of a healthy man, as a challenge, as tools, means, and material. So he felt anger that he should find exaltation only in the wilderness, that this great sense of hope had to be lost when he would return to men and men's work. He thought that this was not right, that man's work should be a higher step, an improvement on nature, not a degradation. He did not want to despise men. He wanted to love and admire them. But he dreaded the sight of the first house, pool room, and movie poster he would encounter on his way. He had always wanted to write music, and he could give no other identity to the thing he sought. If you want to know what it is, he told himself, listen to the first phrases of Tchaikovsky's first concerto, or the last movement of Rachmaninoff's second. Men have not found the words for it, nor the deed, nor the thought, but they have found the music. Let me see that in one single act of man on earth. Let me see it made real. Let me see the answer to the promise of that music. Not servants, nor those served. Not altars and immolations, but the final, the fulfilled, innocent of pain. Don't help me or serve me, but let me see it once, because I need it. Don't work for my happiness, my brothers. Show me yours. Show me that it is possible. Show me your achievement. And the knowledge will give me courage for mine. He saw a blue hole ahead, where the road ended on the crest of a ridge. The blue looked cool and clean, like a film of water stretched in the frame of green branches. It would be funny, he thought, if I came to the edge and found nothing but that blue beyond. Nothing but the sky, ahead, above, and below. He closed his eyes and went on, suspending the possible for a moment, granting himself a dream, a few instants of believing that he would reach the crest, open his eyes, and see the blue radiance of the sky below. His foot touched the ground, breaking his motion. He stopped and opened his eyes. He stood still. In the broad valley far below him in the first sunlight of early morning, he saw a town. Only it was not a town. Towns did not look like that. He had to suspend the possible for a while longer, to seek no questions or explanations, only to look. There were small houses on the ledges of the hill before him, flowing down to the bottom. He knew that the ledges had not been touched, that no artifice had altered the unplanned beauty of the graded steps. Yet some power had known how to build on these ledges in such a way that the houses became inevitable, and one could no longer imagine the hills as beautiful without them, as if the centuries and the series of chances that produced these ledges in the struggle of great blind forces had waited for their final expression, had been only a road to a goal. And the goal was these buildings, part of the hills, shaped by the hills, yet ruling them by giving them meaning. The houses were of plain field stone, like the rocks jutting from the green hillsides, and of glass, great sheets of glass, used as if the sun were invited to complete the structures, sunlight becoming part of the masonry. There were many houses. They were small, they were cut off from one another, and no two of them were alike. But they were like variations on a single theme, like a symphony played by an inexhaustible imagination, and one could still hear the laughter of the force that had been let loose on them, as if that force had run unrestrained, challenging itself to be spent, but had never reached its end. Music, he thought, the promise of the music he had invoked, the sense of it made real. There it was before his eyes. He did not see it, he heard it in chords. He thought that there was a common language of thought, sight, and sound. Was it mathematics? The discipline of reason. Music was mathematics, and architecture was music in stone. He knew he was dizzy because this place below him could not be real. He saw trees, lawns, walks twisting up the hillsides, steps cut in the stone. He saw fountains, swimming pools, tennis courts, and not a sign of life. The place was uninhabited. It did not shock him, not as the sight of it had shocked him. In a way it seemed proper. This was not part of known existence. For the moment, he had no desire to know what it was. After a long time, he glanced about him, and then he saw that he was not alone. Some steps away from him, a man sat on a boulder looking down at the valley. The man seemed absorbed in the sight and had not heard his approach. The man was tall and gaunt and had orange hair. He walked straight to the man, who turned his eyes to him. The eyes were gray and calm. The boy knew suddenly that they felt the same thing, and he could speak as he would not speak to a stranger anywhere else. "That isn't real, is it?" the boy asked, pointing down.
"Why, yes, it is, now," the man answered.
"It's not a movie set or a trick of some kind?"
"No. It's a summer resort. It's just been completed. It will be opened in a few weeks."
"Who built it?"
"I did."
"What's your name?"
"Howard Rourke."
"Thank you," said the boy. He knew that the steady eyes looking at him understood everything those two words had to cover. Howard Rourke inclined his head in acknowledgment. Wheeling his bicycle by his side, the boy took the narrow path down the slope of the hill to the valley and the houses below. Rourke looked after him. He had never seen the boy before, and he would never see him again. He did not know that he had given someone the courage to face a lifetime. Rourke had never understood why he was chosen to build the summer resort at Monadnock Valley. It had happened a year and a half ago in the fall of 1933. He had heard of the project and gone to see Mr. Caleb Bradley, the head of some vast company that had purchased the valley and was doing a great deal of loud promotion. He went to see Bradley as a matter of duty, without hope, merely to add another refusal to his long list of refusals. He had built nothing in New York since the Stoddard Temple. When he entered Bradley's office, he knew that he must forget Monadnock Valley, because this man would never give it to him. Caleb Bradley was a short, pudgy person with a handsome face, between rounded shoulders. The face looked wise and boyish, unpleasantly ageless. It could have been 50 or 20. He had blank blue eyes, sly and bored. But it was difficult for Rourke to forget Monadnock Valley. So he spoke of it, forgetting that speech was useless here. Mr. Bradley listened, obviously interested, but obviously not in what Rourke was saying. Rourke could almost feel some third entity present in the room. Mr. Bradley said little, beyond promising to consider it and to get in touch with him. But then he said a strange thing. He asked, in a voice devoid of all clue to the purpose of the question, neither in approval nor scorn, "You're the architect who built the Stoddard Temple, aren't you, Mr. Rourke?"
"Yes," said Rourke.
"Funny that I hadn't thought of you myself," said Mr. Bradley. Rourke went away thinking that it would have been funny if Mr. Bradley had thought of him. 3 days later, Bradley telephoned and invited him to his office. Rourke came and met 4 other men, the board of the Monadnock Valley Company. They were well-dressed men, and their faces were as closed as Mr. Bradley's. "Please tell these gentlemen what you told me, Mr. Rourke," Bradley said pleasantly. Rourke explained his plan. If what they wished to build was an unusual summer resort for people of moderate incomes, as they had announced, then they should realize that the worst curse of poverty was the lack of privacy. Only the very rich or the very poor of the city could enjoy their summer vacations. The very rich, because they had private estates. The very poor, because they did not mind the feel and smell of one another's flesh on public beaches and public dance floors. The people of good taste and small income had no place to go if they found no rest or pleasure in herds. Why was it assumed that poverty gave one the instincts of cattle? Why not offer these people a place where, for a week or a month, at small cost, they could have what they wanted and needed? He had seen Monadnock Valley. It could be done. Don't touch those hillsides. Don't blast and level them down. Not one huge ant pile of a hotel, but small houses hidden from one another, each a private estate where people could meet or not as they pleased. Not one fish market tank of a swimming pool, but many private swimming pools, as many as the company wished to afford. He could show them how it could be done cheaply. Not one stock farm corral of tennis courts for exhibitionists, but many private tennis courts. Not a place where one went to meet refined company and land a husband in 2 weeks, but a resort for people who enjoyed their own presence well enough and sought only a place where they would be left free to enjoy it. The men listened to him silently. He saw them exchanging glances once in a while. He felt certain that they were the kind of glances people exchange when they cannot laugh at the speaker aloud. But it could not have been that, because he signed a contract to build the Monadnock Valley Summer Resort 2 days later. He demanded Mr. Bradley's initials on every drawing that came out of his drafting room. He remembered the Stoddard Temple. Mr. Bradley initialed, signed, okayed. He agreed to everything. He approved everything. He seemed delighted to let Rourke have his way. But this eager complacence had a peculiar undertone, as if Mr. Bradley were humoring a child. He could learn little about Mr. Bradley. It was said that the man had made a fortune in real estate in the Florida boom. His present company seemed to command unlimited funds, and the names of many wealthy backers were mentioned as shareholders. Rourke never met them. The 4 gentlemen of the board did not appear again, except on short visits to the construction site, where they exhibited little interest. Mr. Bradley was in full charge of everything. But beyond a close watch over the budget, he seemed to like nothing better than to leave Rourke in full charge. In the 18 months that followed, Rourke had no time to wonder about Mr. Bradley. Rourke was building his greatest assignment. For the last year he lived at the construction site, in a shanty hastily thrown together on a bare hillside, a wooden enclosure with a bed, a stove, and a large table. His old draftsmen came to work for him again, some abandoning better jobs in the city to live in shacks and tents, to work in naked plank barracks that served as architect's office. There was so much to build that none of them thought of wasting structural effort on their own shelters. They did not realize until much later that they had lacked comforts, and then they did not believe it, because the year at Monadnock Valley remained in their minds as the strange time, when the earth stopped turning and they lived through 12 months of spring. They did not think of the snow, the frozen clots of earth, wind whistling through the cracks of planking, thin blankets over army cots, stiff fingers stretched over coal stoves in the morning before a pencil could be held steadily. They remembered only the feeling which is the meaning of spring. One's answer to the first blades of grass, the first buds on tree branches, the first blue of the sky. The singing answer, not to grass, trees, and sky, but to the great sense of beginning, of triumphant progression, of certainty in an achievement that nothing will stop. Not from leaves and flowers, but from wooden scaffoldings, from steam shovels, from blocks of stone and sheets of glass rising out of the earth, they received the sense of youth, motion, purpose, fulfillment. They were an army, and it was a crusade. But none of them thought of it in these words, except Stephen Mallory. Stephen Mallory did the fountains and all the sculpture work of Monadnock Valley. But he came to live at the site long before he was needed. Battle, thought Stephen Mallory, is a vicious concept. There is no glory in war, and no beauty in crusades of men. But this was a battle. This was an army and a war, and the highest experience in the life of every man who took part in it. Why? Where was the root of the difference, and the law to explain it? He did not speak of it to anyone, but he saw the same feeling in Mike's face when Mike arrived with the gang of electricians. Mike said nothing, but he winked at Mallory in cheerful understanding.
I told you not to worry, Mike said to him once, without preamble. At the trial, that was. He can't lose. Quarries or no quarries, trials or no trials. They can't beat him, Steve. They just can't. Not the whole goddamn world.
But they had really forgotten the world, thought Mallory. This was a new earth, their own. The hills rose to the sky around them as a wall of protection. And they had another protection. The architect who walked among them, down the snow or the grass of the hillsides, over the boulders and the piled planks, to the drafting tables, to the derricks, to the tops of rising walls, the man who had made this possible, the thoughts in the mind of that man. And not the content of that thought, not the result, not the vision that had created Monadnock Valley, nor the will that had made it real, but the method of his thought, the rule of its function, the method and rule, which were not like those of the world beyond the hills, that stood on guard over the valley, and over the crusaders within it. And then he saw Mr. Bradley come to visit the site, to smile blandly and depart again. Then Mallory felt anger without reason, and fear. Howard, Mallory said one night when they sat together at a fire of dry branches on the hillside over the camp. It's the Stoddard Temple again.
Yes, said Rourke. I think so. But I can't figure out in just what way, or what they're after.
He rolled over on his stomach, and looked down at the panes of glass scattered through the darkness below. They caught reflections from somewhere, and looked like phosphorescent, self-generated springs of light rising out of the ground. He said,
It doesn't matter, Steve, does it? Not what they do about it, nor who comes to live here. Only that we've made it. Would you have missed this, no matter what price they make you pay for it afterward?
No, said Mallory. Rourke had wanted to rent one of the houses for himself and spend the summer there, the first summer of Monadnock Valley's existence. But before the resort was open, he received a wire from New York.
I told you I would, didn't I? It took 5 years to get rid of my friends and brothers, but the Aquitania is now mine. And yours. Come to finish it. Kent Lansing.
So he went back to New York, to see the rubble and cement dust cleared away from the hulk of the unfinished symphony, to see derricks swing girders high over Central Park, to see the gaps of windows filled, the broad decks spread over the roofs of the city, the Aquitania Hotel completed, glowing at night in the park's skyline. He had been very busy in the last 2 years. Monadnock Valley had not been his only commission. From different states, from unexpected parts of the country, calls had come for him. Private homes, small office buildings, modest shops. He had built them, snatching a few hours of sleep on trains and planes that carried him from Monadnock Valley to distant small towns. The story of every commission he received was the same. I was in New York, and I liked the Enright House. I saw the Cord Building. I saw a picture of that temple they tore down. It was as if an underground stream flowed through the country and broke out in sudden springs that shot to the surface at random, in unpredictable places. They were small, inexpensive jobs, but he was kept working. That summer, with Monadnock Valley completed, he had no time to worry about its future fate, but Stephen Mallory worried about it. "Why don't they advertise it, Howard? Why the sudden silence? Have you noticed? There was so much talk about their grand project. So many little items in print. Before they started, there was less and less while we were doing it. And now? Mr. Bradley and company have gone deaf-mute. Now? When you'd expect them to stage a press agent's orgy. Why?"
"I wouldn't know," said Rourke. "I'm an architect, not a rental agent. Why should you worry? We've done our job. Let them do theirs in their own way."
"It's a damn queer way. Did you see their ads, the few they've let dribble out? They say all the things you told them about rest, peace, and privacy, but how they say it. Do you know what those ads amount to, in effect? Come to Monadnock Valley and be bored to death. It actually sounds as if they were trying to keep people away."
"I don't read ads, Steve."
But within a month of its opening, every house in Monadnock Valley was rented. The people who came were a strange mixture. Society men and women who could have afforded more fashionable resorts, young writers and unknown artists, engineers and newspapermen and factory workers. Suddenly, spontaneously, people were talking about Monadnock Valley. There was a need for that kind of a resort, a need no one had tried to satisfy. The place became news, but it was private news. The papers had not discovered it. Mr. Bradley had no press agents. Mr. Bradley and his company had vanished from public life. One magazine, unsolicited, printed 4 pages of photographs of Monadnock Valley and sent a man to interview Howard Rourke. By the end of summer, the homes were leased in advance for the following year. In October, early one morning, the door of Rourke's reception room flew open and Stephen Mallory rushed in, making straight for Rourke's office. The secretary tried to stop him. Rourke was working and no interruptions were allowed. But Mallory shoved her aside and tore into the office, slamming the door behind. She noticed that he held a newspaper in his hand. Rourke glanced up at him from the drafting table and dropped his pencil. He knew that this was the way Mallory's face had looked when he shot at Ellsworth Toohey. "Well, Howard, do you want to know why you got Monadnock Valley?" He threw the newspaper down on the table. Rourke saw the heading of a story on the third page. "Caleb Bradley, arrested." "It's all there," said Mallory. "Don't read it. It will make you sick."
"All right, Steve, what is it?"
"They sold 200% of it."
"Who did? Of what?"
"Bradley and his gang." "Of Monadnock Valley." Mallory spoke with a forced, vicious, self-torturing precision. "They thought it was worthless from the first. They got the land practically for nothing. They thought it was no place for a resort at all, out of the way with no bus lines or movie theaters around. They thought the time wasn't right and the public wouldn't go for it. They made a lot of noise and sold shares to a lot of wealthy suckers. It was just a huge fraud. They sold 200% of the place. They got twice what it cost them to build it. They were certain it would fail. They wanted it to fail. They expected no profits to distribute. They had a nice scheme ready for how to get out of it when the place went bankrupt. They were prepared for anything, except for seeing it turn into the kind of success it is. And they couldn't go on, because now they'd have to pay their backers twice the amount the place earned each year, and it's earning plenty. And they thought they had arranged for certain failure. Howard, don't you understand? They chose you as the worst architect they could find." Rourke threw his head back and laughed. "God damn you, Howard, it's not funny."
"Sit down, Steve. Stop shaking. You look as if you'd just seen a whole field of butchered bodies."
"I have. I've seen worse. I've seen the root. I've seen what makes such fields possible. What did the damn fools think of as horror? Wars, murders, fires, earthquakes, to hell with that. This is horror. That story in the paper. That's what men should dread and fight and scream and call the worst shame on their record. Howard, I'm thinking of all the explanations of evil and all the remedies offered for it through the centuries. None of them worked. None of them explained or cured anything. But the root of evil, my drooling beast, it's there, Howard, in that story. In that. And in the souls of the smug bastards who'll read it and say, oh, well, genius must always struggle. It's good for him. And then go and look for some village idiot to help, to teach him how to weave baskets. That's the drooling beast in action. Howard, think of Monadnock. Close your eyes and see it. And then think that the men who ordered it believed it was the worst thing they could build. Howard, there's something wrong, something very terribly wrong in the world if you were given your greatest job as a filthy joke.
When will you stop thinking about that? About the world and me? When will you learn to forget it? When will Dominique...
He stopped. They had not mentioned that name in each other's presence for 5 years. He saw Mallory's eyes, intent and shocked. Mallory realized that his words had hurt Rourke, hurt him enough to force this admission. But Rourke turned to him and said deliberately,
Dominique used to think just as you do.
Mallory had never spoken of what he guessed about Rourke's past. Their silence had always implied that Mallory understood, that Rourke knew it, and that it was not to be discussed. But now Mallory asked, Are you still waiting for her to come back? Mrs. Gale Winant, God damn her.
Rourke said without emphasis, Shut up, Steve.
Mallory whispered, I'm sorry. Rourke walked to his table and said, his voice normal again,
Go home, Steve, and forget about Bradley. They'll all be suing one another now, but we won't be dragged in, and they won't destroy Monadnock. Forget it and get out. I have to work.
He brushed the newspaper off the table with his elbow and bent over the sheets of drafting paper. There was a scandal over the revelations of the financing methods behind Monadnock Valley. There was a trial, a few gentlemen sentenced to the penitentiary, and a new management taking Monadnock over for the shareholders. Rourke was not involved. He was busy, and he forgot to read the accounts of the trial in the papers. Mr. Bradley admitted, in apology to his partners, that he would be damned if he could have expected a resort built on a crazy, unsociable plan ever to become successful.
I did all I could. I chose the worst fool I could find.
Then Austin Heller wrote an article about Howard Rourke and Monadnock Valley. He spoke of all the buildings Rourke had designed, and he put into words the things Rourke had said in architecture. Only they were not Austin Heller's usual quiet words. They were a ferocious cry of admiration and of anger. And may we be damned if greatness must reach us through fraud. The article started a violent controversy in art circles.
Howard, Mallory said one day, some months later.
You're famous.
Yes, said Rourke. I suppose so.
3/4 of them don't know what it's all about, but they've heard the other 1/4 fighting over your name, and so now they feel they must pronounce it with respect. Of the fighting 1/4, 4/10 are those who hate you, 3/10 are those who feel they must express an opinion in any controversy, 2/10 are those who play safe and herald any discovery, and 1/10 are those who understand. But they've all found out suddenly that there is a Howard Rourke, and that he's an architect. The AGA Bulletin refers to you as a great but unruly talent. And the Museum of the Future has hung up photographs of Monadnock, the Enright House, the Cord Building, and the Aquitania, under beautiful glass, next to the room where they've got Gordon L. Prescott. And still, I'm glad.
Kent Lansing said one evening, Heller did a grand job. Do you remember, Howard, what I told you once about the psychology of a pretzel? Don't despise the middleman. He's necessary. Someone had to tell them. It takes 2 to make every great career. The man who is great, and the man, almost rarer, who is great enough to see greatness and say so.
Ellsworth Toohey wrote,
The paradox in all this preposterous noise is the fact that Mr. Caleb Bradley is the victim of a grave injustice. His ethics are open to censure, but his aesthetics were unimpeachable. He exhibited sounder judgment in matters of architectural merit than Mr. Austin Heller,
the outmoded reactionary who was suddenly turned art critic. Mr. Caleb Bradley was martyred by the bad taste of his tenants. In the opinion of this column, his sentence should have been commuted in recognition of his artistic discrimination. Monadnock Valley is a fraud, but not merely a financial one. There was little response to Rourke's fame among the solid gentlemen of wealth who were the steadiest source of architectural commissions. The men who had said, "Rourke, never heard of him," now said, "Rourke, he's too sensational." But there were men who were impressed by the simple fact that Rourke had built a place which made money for owners who didn't want to make money. This was more convincing than abstract artistic discussions. And there was the 1/10th who understood. In the year after Monadnock Valley, Rourke built 2 private homes in Connecticut, a movie theater in Chicago, a hotel in Philadelphia. In the spring of 1936, a western city completed plans for a World's Fair to be held next year, an international exposition to be known as the March of the Centuries. The committee of distinguished civic leaders in charge of the project chose a council of the country's best architects to design the fair. The civic leaders wished to be conspicuously progressive. Howard Rourke was one of the 8 architects chosen. When he received the invitation, Rourke appeared before the committee and explained that he would be glad to design the fair, alone. "But you can't be serious, Mr. Rourke," the chairman declared. "After all, with a stupendous undertaking of this nature, we want the best that can be had. I mean, 2 heads are better than 1, you know, and 8 heads. Why, you can see for yourself the best talents of the country, the brightest names. You know, friendly consultation, cooperation, and collaboration. You know what makes great achievements?"
"I do."
"Then you realize, if you want me, you'll have to let me do it all alone. I don't work with councils." "You wish to reject an opportunity like this, a spot in history, a chance of world fame, practically a chance of immortality?"
"I don't work with collectives. I don't consult, I don't cooperate, I don't collaborate."
There was a great deal of angry comment on Rourke's refusal in architectural circles. People said, "The conceited bastard." The indignation was too sharp and raw for a mere piece of professional gossip. Each man took it as a personal insult. Each felt himself qualified to alter, advise, and improve the work of any man living.
"The incident illustrates to perfection," wrote Ellsworth Toohey, "the antisocial nature of Mr. Howard Rourke's egotism, the arrogance of the unbridled individualism which he has always personified."
Among the 8 chosen to design the March of the Centuries were Peter Keating, Gordon L. Prescott, Ralston Holcomb. "I won't work with Howard Rourke," said Peter Keating when he saw the list of the council. "You'll have to choose. It's he or I." He was informed that Mr. Rourke had declined. Keating assumed leadership over the council. The press stories about the progress of the fair's construction referred to Peter Keating and his associates. Keating had acquired a sharp, intractable manner in the last few years. He snapped orders and lost his patience before the smallest difficulty. When he lost his patience, he screamed at people. He had a vocabulary of insults that carried a caustic, insidious, almost feminine malice. His face was sullen. In the fall of 1936, Rourke moved his office to the top floor of the Cord building. He had thought, when he designed that building, that it would be the place of his office someday. When he saw the inscription, "Howard Rourke, Architect," on his new door, he stopped for a moment. Then he walked into the office. His own room, at the end of a long suite, had 3 walls of glass high over the city. He stopped in the middle of the room. Through the broad panes, he could see the Fargo store, the Enright House, the Aquitania Hotel. He walked to the windows facing south and stood there for a long time. At the tip of Manhattan, far in the distance, he could see the Dana Building by Henry Cameron. On an afternoon of November, returning to his office after a visit to the site of a house under construction on Long Island, Rourke entered the reception room, shaking his drenched raincoat, and saw a look of suppressed excitement on the face of his secretary. She had been waiting impatiently for his return. "Mr. Rourke, this is probably something very big," she said. "I made an appointment for you for 3 o'clock tomorrow afternoon at his office."
Whose office?
He telephoned half an hour ago. Mr. Gale Winan,
Chapter 2. A sign hung over the entrance door, a reproduction of the paper's masthead. The New York Banner. The sign was small, a statement of fame and power that needed no emphasis. It was like a fine, mocking smile that justified the building's bare ugliness. The building was a factory, scornful of all ornament save the implications of that masthead. The entrance lobby looked like the mouth of a furnace. Elevators drew a stream of human fuel and spat it out. The men did not hurry, but they moved with subdued haste, the propulsion of purpose. Nobody loitered in that lobby. The elevator doors clicked like valves, a pulsating rhythm in their sound. Drops of red and green light flashed on a wallboard, signaling the progress of cars high in space. It looked as if everything in that building were run by such control boards in the hands of an authority aware of every motion, as if the building were flowing with channeled energy, functioning smoothly, soundlessly, a magnificent machine that nothing could destroy. Nobody paid any attention to the red-headed man who stopped in the lobby for a moment. Howard Rourke looked up at the tiled vault. He had never hated anyone. Somewhere in this building was its owner, the man who had made him feel his nearest approach to hatred. Gale Winand glanced at the small clock on his desk. In a few minutes he had an appointment with an architect. The interview, he thought, would not be difficult. He had held many such interviews in his life. He merely had to speak. He knew what he wanted to say, and nothing was required of the architect except a few sounds signifying understanding. His glance went from the clock back to the sheets of proofs on his desk. He read an editorial by Alva Skerritt on the public feeding of squirrels in Central Park, and a column by Ellsworth Toohey on the great merits of an exhibition of paintings done by the workers of the city's Department of Sanitation. A buzzer rang on his desk, and his secretary's voice said, "Mr. Howard Rourke, Mr. Winand."
"Okay," said Winand, flicking the switch off.
As his hand moved back, he noticed the row of buttons at the edge of his desk, bright little knobs with a color code of their own, each representing the end of a wire that stretched to some part of the building. Each wire controlling some man. Each man controlling many men under his orders. Each group of men contributing to the final shape of words on paper to go into millions of homes, into millions of human brains. These little knobs of colored plastic there under his fingers. But he had no time to let the thought amuse him. The door of his office was opening. He moved his hand away from the buttons. Winand was not certain that he missed a moment, that he did not rise at once as courtesy demanded, but remained seated, looking at the man who entered. Perhaps he had risen immediately, and it only seemed to him that a long time preceded his movement. Rourke was not certain that he stopped when he entered the office, that he did not walk forward, but stood looking at the man behind the desk. Perhaps there had been no break in his steps, and it only seemed to him that he had stopped. But there had been a moment, when both forgot the terms of immediate reality, when Winand forgot his purpose in summoning this man, when Rourke forgot that this man was Dominique's husband, when no door, desk, or stretch of carpet existed, only the total awareness for each of the man before him. Only two thoughts meeting in the middle of the room. This is Gale Winand. This is Howard Rourke. Then Winand rose. His hand motioned in simple invitation to the chair beside his desk. Rourke approached and sat down, and they did not notice that they had not greeted each other. Winand smiled and said what he had never intended to say. He said very simply,
"I don't think you'll want to work for me."
"I want to work for you," said Rourke, who had come here prepared to refuse.
"Have you seen the kinds of things I've built?"
"Yes."
Winand smiled. "This is different. It's not for my public. It's for me."
"You've never built anything for yourself before?"
"No. If one doesn't count the cage I have up on a roof and this old printing factory here. Can you tell me why I've never built a structure of my own, with the means of erecting a city if I wished?"
"I don't know."
"I think you'd know."
He forgot that he did not allow men he hired the presumption of personal speculation upon him.
"Because you've been unhappy," said Rourke. He said it simply, without insolence, as if nothing but total honesty were possible to him here. This was not the beginning of an interview, but the middle. It was like a continuation of something begun long ago. Wynand said, "Make that clear.
I think you understand.
I want to hear you explain it."
"Most people build as they live, as a matter of routine and senseless accident, but a few understand that building is a great symbol. We live in our minds, and existence is the attempt to bring that life into physical reality, to state it in gesture and form. For the man who understands this, a house he owns is a statement of his life. If he doesn't build when he has the means, it's because his life has not been what he wanted."
"You don't think it's preposterous to say that to me, of all people?"
"No."
"I don't either." Rourke smiled. "But you and I are the only two who'd say it. Either part of it, that I didn't have what I wanted, or that I could be included among the few expected to understand any sort of great symbols. You don't want to retract that either?"
"No."
"How old are you?"
36.
"I owned most of the papers I have now, when I was 36.
He added,
"I didn't mean that as any kind of a personal remark. I don't know why I said that. I just happened to think of it."
"What do you wish me to build for you?"
"My home."
Wynand felt that the two words had some impact on Rourke, apart from any normal meaning they could convey. He sensed it without reason. He wanted to ask, "What's the matter?" but couldn't, since Rourke had really shown nothing.
"You were right in your diagnosis," said Wynand. "Because, you see, now I do want to build a house of my own. Now I'm not afraid of a visible shape for my life. If you want it said directly, as you did, now I'm happy."
"What kind of a house?"
"In the country. I've purchased the site, an estate in Connecticut, 500 acres. What kind of a house?" "You'll decide that."
"Did Mrs. Wynand choose me for the job?"
"No, Mrs. Wynand knows nothing about this. It was I who wanted to move out of the city, and she agreed. I did ask her to select the architect. My wife is the former Dominique Francon. She was once a writer on architecture. But she preferred to leave the choice to me. You want to know why I picked you? I took a long time to decide. I felt rather lost at first. I had never heard of you. I didn't know any architects at all. I mean this literally. And I'm not forgetting the years I've spent in real estate, the things I've built, and the imbeciles who built them for me. This is not a stone ridge. This is... what did you call it? A statement of my life? Then I saw Monadnock. It was the first thing that made me remember your name. But I gave myself a long test. I went around the country looking at homes, hotels, all sorts of buildings. Every time I saw one I liked and asked who had designed it, the answer was always the same, Howard Rourke. So I called you." He added, "Shall I tell you how much I admire your work?"
"Thank you," said Rourke.
He closed his eyes for an instant. "You know, I didn't want to meet you."
"Why?"
"Have you heard about my art gallery?"
"Yes."
"I never meet the men whose work I love. The work means too much to me. I don't want the men to spoil it. They usually do. They're an anticlimax to their own talent." "You're not. I don't mind talking to you. I told you this only because I want you to know that I respect very little in life, but I respect the things in my gallery and your buildings, and man's capacity to produce work like that. Maybe it's the only religion I've ever had."
He shrugged. "I think I've destroyed, perverted, corrupted just about everything that exists. But I've never touched that."
"Why are you looking at me like this?"
"I'm sorry. Please tell me about the house you want."
"I want it to be a palace. Only I don't think palaces are very luxurious. They're so big, so promiscuously public. A small house is the true luxury, a residence for two people only, for my wife and me. It won't be necessary to allow for a family. We don't intend to have children, nor for visitors. We don't intend to entertain. One guest room, in case we should need it, but not more than that. Living room, dining room, library, two studies, one bedroom, servants' quarters, garage. That's the general idea. I'll give you the details later. The cost, whatever you need.
The appearance?
He smiled, shrugging.
I've seen your buildings. The man who wants to tell you what a house should look like must either be able to design it better, or shut up. I'll say only that I want my house to have the Rourke quality.
What is that?
I think you understand.
I want to hear you explain it.
I think some buildings are cheap show-offs. All front. And some are cowards apologizing for themselves in every brick. And some are the eternal, unfit, botched, malicious, and false. Your buildings have one sense above all. A sense of joy. Not a placid joy. A difficult, demanding kind of joy. The kind that makes one feel as if it were an achievement to experience it. One looks and thinks, I'm a better person if I can feel that.
Rourke said slowly, not in the tone of an answer.
I suppose it was inevitable.
What?
That you would see that.
Why do you say it as if you regretted my being able to see it?
I don't regret it.
Listen, don't hold it against me. The things I've built before.
I don't.
It's all the stone ridges and Noyes Belmont hotels and wine and papers that made it possible for me to have a house by you. Isn't that a luxury worth achieving? Does it matter how? They were the means. You're the end.
You don't have to justify yourself to me.
I wasn't just... Yes. I think that's what I was doing.
You don't need to. I wasn't thinking of what you've built.
What were you thinking?
That I'm helpless against anyone who sees what you saw in my buildings.
You felt you wanted help against me?
No. Only I don't feel helpless as a rule.
I'm not prompted to justify myself as a rule either.
Then,
it's all right, isn't it?
Yes.
I must tell you much more about the house I want. I suppose an architect is like a father confessor. He must know everything about the people who are to live in his house, since what he gives them is more personal than their clothes or food. Please consider it in that spirit. And forgive me if you notice that this is difficult for me to say. I've never gone to confession. You see, I want this house because I'm very desperately in love with my wife. What's the matter? Do you think it's an irrelevant statement?
No. Go on.
I can't stand to see my wife among other people. It's not jealousy. It's much more and much worse. I can't stand to see her walking down the streets of a city. I can't share her, not even with shops, theaters, taxicabs, or sidewalks. I must take her away. I must put her out of reach where nothing can touch her, not in any sense. This house is to be a fortress. My architect is to be my guard.
Rourke sat looking straight at him. He had to keep his eyes on Wynand in order to be able to listen. Wynand felt the effort in that glance. He did not recognize it as effort, only as strength. He felt himself supported by the glance. He found that nothing was hard to confess.
This house is to be a prison. No, not quite that. A treasury. A vault to guard things too precious for sight. But it must be more. It must be a separate world, so beautiful that we'll never miss the one we left. A prison only by the power of its own perfection. Not bars and ramparts, but your talent standing as a wall between us and the world. That's what I want of you. And more. Have you ever built a temple?
For a moment, Rourke had no strength to answer.
But he saw that the question was genuine. Wynand didn't know.
Yes, said Rourke.
Then think of this commission as you would think of a temple. A temple to Dominique Wynand. I want you to meet her before you design it.
I met Mrs. Wynand some years ago.
You have? Then you understand.
I do.
Wynand saw Rourke's hand lying on the edge of his desk, the long fingers pressed to the glass next to the proofs of the banner. The proofs were folded carelessly. he saw the heading One Small Voice inside the page. He looked at Rourke's hand. He thought he would like to have a bronze paperweight made of it, and how beautiful it would look on his desk.
"Now you know what I want. Go ahead, start at once. Drop anything else you're doing. I'll pay whatever you wish. I want that house by summer." "Oh, forgive me. Too much association with bad architects. I haven't asked whether you want to do it."
Rourke's hand moved first. He took it off the desk.
"Yes," said Rourke. "I'll do it."
Wynand saw the prints of the fingers left on the glass, distinct, as if the skin had cut grooves in the surface, and the grooves were wet.
"How long will it take you?" Wynand asked. "You'll have it by July. Of course you must see the site. I want to show it to you myself. Shall I drive you down there tomorrow morning?"
"If you wish."
"Be here at 9.
"Yes."
"Do you want me to draw up a contract? I have no idea how you prefer to work. As a rule, before I deal with a man in any matter, I make it a point to know everything about him from the day of his birth or earlier. I've never checked up on you. I simply forgot. It didn't seem necessary."
"I can answer any question you wish."
Wynand smiled and shook his head.
"No. There's nothing I need to ask you. Except about the business arrangements."
"I never make any conditions, except one. If you accept the preliminary drawings of the house, it is to be built as I designed it, without any alterations of any kind."
"Certainly. That's understood. I've heard you don't work otherwise. But will you mind if I don't give you any publicity on this house? I know it would help you professionally, but I want this building kept out of the newspapers."
"I won't mind that."
"Will you promise not to release pictures of it for publication?"
"I promise."
"Thank you. I'll make up for it. You may consider the Wynand papers as your personal press service. I'll give you all the plugging you want on any other works of yours."
"I don't want any plugging."
Wynand laughed aloud.
"What a thing to say, and what a place! I don't think you have any idea how your fellow architects would have conducted this interview. I don't believe you were actually conscious at any time that you were speaking to Gail Wynand."
"I was," said Rourke.
"This was my way of thanking you. I don't always like being Gail Wynand."
"I know that."
"I'm going to change my mind and ask you a personal question. You said you'd answer anything."
"I will."
"Have you always liked being Howard Rourke?"
Rourke smiled. The smile was amused, astonished, involuntarily contemptuous.
"You've answered," said Wynand.
Then he rose and said,
9 o'clock tomorrow morning," extending his hand.
When Rourke had gone, Wynand sat behind his desk, smiling. He moved his hand toward one of the plastic buttons and stopped. He realized that he had to assume a different manner, his usual manner, that he could not speak as he had spoken in the last half hour. Then he understood what had been strange about the interview. For the first time in his life, he had spoken to a man without feeling the reluctance, the sense of pressure, the need of disguise he had always experienced when he spoke to people. There had been no strain, and no need of strain. As if he had spoken to himself. He pressed the button and said to his secretary,
"Tell the morgue to send me everything they have on Howard Rourke."
"Guess what?"
said Alvis Garrett, his voice begging to be begged for information. Ellsworth Toohey waved a hand impatiently in a brushing-off motion, not raising his eyes from his desk.
"Go away, Alva. I'm busy."
"No, but this is interesting, Ellsworth. Really, it's interesting. I know you'll want to know."
Toohey lifted his head and looked at him, the faint contraction of boredom in the corners of his eyes, letting Skerritt understand that this moment of attention was a favor. He drawled, in a tone of emphasized patience,
"All right. What is it?"
Skerritt saw nothing to resent in Toohey's manner. Toohey had treated him like that for the last year or longer. Skerritt had not noticed the transition in their relationship. By the time he noticed the change, it was too late to resent it. It had become normal to them both. Skerritt smiled, like a bright pupil who expects the teacher to praise him for discovering an error in the teacher's own textbook.
Ellsworth, your private FBI is slipping.
What are you talking about?
That you don't know what Gale's been doing, and you always make such a point of keeping yourself informed.
What don't I know?
Guess who is in his office today?
My dear Alva, I have no time for quiz games.
You wouldn't guess in 1,000 years.
Very well, since the only way to get rid of you is to play the vaudeville stooge, I shall ask the proper question. Who was in dear Gale's office today?
Howard Rourke.
Toohey turned to him full face, forgetting to dole out his attention, and said incredulously,
No.
Yes,
said Skerritt, proud of the effect.
Well,
said Toohey, and burst out laughing. Skerritt half-smiled, tentatively, puzzled, anxious to join in, but not quite certain of the cause for amusement.
Yes, it's funny, but just exactly why, Ellsworth?
Oh, Alva, it would take so long to tell you.
I had an idea it might—
Haven't you any sense of the spectacular, Alva? Don't you like fireworks? If you want to know what to expect— Just think that the worst wars are religious wars between sects of the same religion, or civil wars between brothers of the same race.
I don't quite follow you.
Oh, dear, I have so many followers, I brush them out of my hair.
Well, I'm glad you're so cheerful about it, but I thought it's bad.
Of course it's bad, but not for us.
But look, you know how we've gone out on a limb, you particularly on how this Rourke is just about the worst architect in town— And if now our own boss hires him, isn't it going to be embarrassing?
Oh, that? Oh, maybe.
Well, I'm glad you take it that way.
What was he doing in Winan's office?
Is it a commission? That's what I don't know. Can't find out. Nobody knows.
Have you heard of Mr. Winan planning to build anything lately?
No. Have you?
No. I guess my FBI is slipping. Oh, well, one does the best one can.
But you know, Ellsworth, I had an idea. I had an idea where this might be very helpful to us indeed.
What idea?
Ellsworth, Gale's been impossible lately.
Skerritt uttered it solemnly, with the air of imparting a discovery. Toohey sat, half-smiling.
Well, of course you predicted it, Ellsworth. You were right. You're always right. I'll be damned if I can figure out just what's happening to him, whether it's Dominique or some sort of a change of life or what. But something's happening. Why does he get fit suddenly and start reading every damn line of every damn edition and raise hell for the silliest reasons? He's killed 3 of my best editorials lately, and he's never done that to me before, never. You know what he said to me? He said, Motherhood is wonderful, Alva, but for God's sake, go easy on the bilge. There's a limit even for intellectual depravity. What depravity! That was the sweetest Mother's Day editorial I ever put together. Honest, I was touched myself. Since when has he learned to talk about depravity? The other day he called Jules Fogler a bargain basement mind, right to his face, and threw his Sunday piece into the wastebasket. A swell piece, too, on the Workers' Theater. Jules Fogler, our best writer. No wonder Gale hasn't got a friend left in the place. If they hated his guts before, you ought to hear them now.
I've heard them.
He's losing his grip, Ellsworth. I don't know what I'd do if it weren't for you and the swell bunch of people you picked. They're practically our whole actual working staff, those youngsters of yours. Not our old sacred cows who are writing themselves out anyway. Those bright kids will keep the banner going. But Gale... Listen. Last week he fired Dwight Carson. Now, you know, I think that was significant. Of course, Dwight was just a dead weight and a damn nuisance. But he was the first one of those special pets of Gale's. The boys who sold their souls. So in a way, you see, I liked having Dwight around. It was all right. It was healthy. It was a relic of Gale's best days. I always said it was Gale's safety valve. And when he suddenly let Carson go, I didn't like it, Ellsworth. I didn't like it at all.
What is this, Alva? Are you telling me things I don't know? Or is this just in the nature of letting off steam, do forgive the mixed metaphor, on my shoulder?
I guess so. I don't like to knock Gale, but I've been so damn mad for so long I'm fit to be tied. But here's what I'm driving at. This Howard Rourke, what does he make you think of?
I could write a volume on that, Alva. This is hardly the time to launch into such an undertaking.
No, but I mean, what's the one thing we know about him? That he's a crank and a freak and a fool, all right, but what else? That he's one of those fools you can't budge with love or money or a 16-inch gun. He's worse than Dwight Carson, worse than the whole lot of Gale's pets put together. Well, get my point? What's Gale going to do when he comes up against that kind of a man?
One of several possible things.
One thing only if I know Gale. And I know Gale. That's why I feel kind of hopeful. This is what he's needed for a long time. A swig of his old medicine. The safety valve. He'll go out to break that guy's spine. And it will be good for Gale. The best thing in the world. Bring him back to normal. That was my idea, Ellsworth.
He waited, saw no complimentary enthusiasm on Tui's face, and finished, lamely.
Well, I might be wrong. I don't know. It might mean nothing at all. I just thought that was psychology.
That's what it was, Alva.
Then you think it'll work that way?
It might.
Or it might be much worse than anything you imagine.
But it's of no importance to us anymore. Because, you see, Alva, as far as the banner is concerned, if it came down to a showdown between us and our boss, we don't have to be afraid of Mr. Gale Wynand any longer.
When the boy from the morgue entered, carrying a thick envelope of clippings, Wynand looked up from his desk and said,
"That much? I didn't know he was so famous."
"Well, it's the Stoddard trial, Mr. Wynand."
The boy stopped. There was nothing wrong. Only the ridges on Wynand's forehead, and he did not know Wynand well enough to know what these meant. He wondered what made him feel as if he should be afraid. After a moment, Wynand said,
"All right. Thank you."
The boy deposited the envelope on the glass surface of the desk and walked out. Wynand sat looking at the bulging shape of yellow paper. He saw it reflected in the glass as if the bulk had eaten through the surface and grown roots to his desk. He looked at the walls of his office, and he wondered whether they contained a power which could save him from opening that envelope. Then he pulled himself erect. He put both forearms in a straight line along the edge of the desk, his fingers stretched and meeting. He looked down past his nostrils at the surface of the desk. He sat for a moment, grave, proud, collected, like the angular mummy of a pharaoh. Then he moved one hand, pulled the envelope forward, opened it, and began to read. "Sacrilege," by Ellsworth M. Tui. "The Churches of Our Childhood," by Alva Skerritt. Editorials, sermons, speeches, statements, the banner unleashed full blast, photographs, cartoons, interviews, resolutions of protest, letters to the editor. He read every word, methodically, his hands on the edge of the desk, fingers meeting, not lifting the clippings, not touching them, reading them as they lay on top of the pile, moving a hand only to turn a clipping over and read the one beneath, moving the hand with a mechanical perfection of timing, the fingers rising as his eyes took the last word, not allowing the clipping to remain in sight a second longer than necessary. But he stopped for a long time to look at the photographs of the Stoddard Temple. He stopped longer to look at one of Rourke's pictures, the picture of exultation, captioned, "Are you happy, Mr. Superman?" He tore it from the story it illustrated and slipped it into his desk drawer. Then he continued reading. The trial, the testimony of Ellsworth M. Tui, of Peter Keating, of Ralston Holcomb, of Gordon L. Prescott. No quotations from the testimony of Dominique Francone, only a brief report. The defense rests. A few mentions in one small voice. Then a gap. The next clipping dated 3 years later, Monadnock Valley. It was late when he finished reading. His secretaries had left. He felt the sense of empty rooms and halls around him. But he heard the sound of the presses, a low rumbling vibration that went through every room. He had always liked that, the sound of the building's heart beating. He listened. They were running off tomorrow's banner. He sat without moving for a long time.
Chapter 3.
Rourke and Wynand stood on the top of a hill, looking over a spread of land that sloped away in a long, gradual curve. Bare trees rose on the hilltop and descended to the shore of a lake, their branches, geometrical compositions cut through the air. The color of the sky, a clear, fragile blue-green, made the air colder. The cold washed the colors of the earth, revealing that they were not colors, but only the elements from which color was to come. The dead brown, not a full brown, but a future green. The tired purple, an overture to flame. The gray, a prelude to gold. The earth was like the outline of a great story, like the steel frame of a building, to be filled and finished, holding all the splendor of the future in naked simplification.
"Where do you think the house should stand?" asked Wynand.
"Here," said Rourke.
"I hoped you'd choose this."
Wynand had driven his car from the city, and they had walked for 2 hours down the paths of his new estate, through deserted lanes, through a forest, past the lake, to the hill. Now Wynand waited, while Rourke stood looking at the countryside spread under his feet. Wynand wondered what rains this man was gathering from all the points of the landscape into his hand. When Rourke turned to him, Wynand asked,
"May I speak to you now?"
"Of course."
Rourke smiled, amused by the deference which he had not requested. Wynand's voice sounded clear and brittle, like the color of the sky above them, with the same quality of ice-green radiance.
"Why did you accept this commission?"
"Because I'm an architect for hire.
You know what I mean."
"I'm not sure I do."
"Don't you hate my guts?"
"No. Why should I?"
"You want me to speak of it first?"
"Of what?"
"The Stoddard Temple."
Rourke smiled.
"So you did check up on me since yesterday."
"I read our clippings."
He waited, but Rourke said nothing.
"All of them."
His voice was harsh, half defiance, half plea.
"Everything we said about you."
The calm of Rourke's face drove him to fury. He went on, giving slow, full value to each word.
"We called you an incompetent fool, a tyro, a charlatan, a swindler, an egomaniac.
Stop torturing yourself."
Wynand closed his eyes, as if Rourke had struck him. In a moment, he said,
"Mr. Rourke, you don't know me very well. You might as well learn this. I don't apologize. I never apologize for any of my actions."
"What made you think of apology?"
"I haven't asked for it. I stand by every one of those descriptive terms. I stand by every word printed in the banner."
"I haven't asked you to repudiate it."
"I know what you think. You understood that I didn't know about the Stoddard Temple yesterday. I had forgotten the name of the architect involved. You concluded it wasn't I who led that campaign against you. You're right, it wasn't I. I was away at the time. But you don't understand that the campaign was in the true and proper spirit of the banner. It was in strict accordance with the banner's function. No one is responsible for it but me. Alva Skerritt was doing only what I taught him. Had I been in town, I would have done the same."
"That's your privilege."
"You don't believe I would have done it?"
"No."
"I haven't asked you for compliments, and I haven't asked you for pity.